to A Galaxy Not So Far Away, a Mysterious Galaxy podcast. I'm your host, Becca, and this is normally where my co-host Gary would introduce himself, but he's a bit under the weather, so I'm solo today. But I'm not alone. Today we have with us Mysterious Galaxy co-owner and bookseller Matt.
Hello.
And a very special guest and a good friend of mine, author Sarah Kuhn.
Hi.
Today we're going to be discussing representation in the media, something I know that Sarah knows a lot about. You know, if you're part of any minority group, whether it be race, body size, gender, sexuality, or any mixture of those, then you've most likely, you know, suffered the severe lacking of seeing yourself in the media you consume. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
Hooray!
So, Sarah, I know that this is something that you talk about all the time, and that's why I sort of, like, left it up to you if you wanted to politely be like, this is not what I want to discuss on a show for the millionth time, but thank you for talking to us about it, because I feel like you're one of the people that has the most important stuff to say about it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind talking about it at all. I think the only times when maybe I do mind is when I know someone is maybe not coming at it with the best intentions. Or maybe needs like a 101 lesson that I'm a little tired of giving, but I knew that that would not be the case with y'all, so I'm happy to talk.
Yeah, I mean, I won't speak for Matt, but as a fat queer person, I certainly don't need the 101 lesson on representation mattering. Yes.
I mean, I think I am the general target for a 101 lesson as a straight white male. But I do have a pretty good background in, like, literary criticism and, you know, reading diverse literature, so
yeah,
hopefully I don't embarrass myself.
I think the fact that you own, like, one of the most awesome bookstores around means that you're probably exposed to a lot of amazing work and new ideas and things like that on a regular basis, so I'm not worried about you.
It does help.
So Sarah, obviously in your work you predominantly discuss characters of Asian backgrounds. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you focus on your culture and background in the literature you write, as opposed to, like, writing about other races, maybe?
Sure. You know, like, I'm Asian American, hopefully, obviously. I guess you can't tell from, like, just my voice, but I'm Asian American. I'm biracial, Japanese American, third generation. And it's interesting because that was actually not so much the case in terms of me, you know, writing characters from my background when I first started writing or thinking about writing. I think I just assumed that that was not something that was marketable or that was something people even wanted to read. I think that a lot of us who are from marginalized backgrounds tend to go through a period of self-rejection. I know that Melinda Lowe wrote a really great essay on that that sort of helped me kind of focus in on that idea. But yeah, I never really saw myself as a main character or protagonist growing up. I just thought I was kind
of... Which is insane because of all of the patterns you wear. Like, you are absolutely the ideal main character of the story.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of us, it just takes a long time to get there. And it maybe takes us a long time to get there even in our own lives. So it wasn't really until much later, you know, I had written this novella that I think Mysterious Galaxy was actually one of the first, like, brick and mortar bookstores to stock. Just because, you know, novella, like, it was self-published. Like, it wasn't necessarily something I saw in a lot of bookstores. But it was called One Con Glory. And it was basically like a nerd girl rom-com that takes place at a comic book convention. And
I love it so much.
Thank you. It feels like it's like I haven't actually looked at it again in so long, but obviously it's still dear to my heart. And I remember when I was first writing that, you know, it was really kind of one of my first serious attempts at prose fiction. And I remember having this thought of this character. She's kind of like an aggressive geek girl. She gets into a lot of fights with people about things like X-Men continuity. She's a reporter. I was a reporter at the time. She goes to a lot of conventions. I go to a lot of conventions. And
I did not know that. I didn't know that you were a reporter.
Yeah, I was a journalist. I was a journalist for actually a long time. And that was how, you know, I started, like, covering a lot of geek stuff.
Gosh, Lois Lane over here.
That's what I was aiming for, really. She was kind of my idol. And, you know, what I think the thing I was probably best known for was I wrote these Buffy reviews for IGN, and they got a little bit of like a following. People still like email me and are like, "Are you the Sarah who wrote about Buffy the Vampire Slayer for IGN?" I'm like, "Yes, that is me." But this character, you know, she was not exactly me, but she was a lot like me. And when I was kind of thinking about her and what she was like and what she did, I remember thinking, should she be Asian American like me, since all of these other things are like me? Does that make sense? And I did the immediate kind of self-rejection thing of like, oh no, because if I do that, then this whole story obviously has to be about racism. It has to be about, you know, it has to be about Asian, like her being Asian, like, it has to be about pain, like all of these things that are kind of like hammered into us, even though they aren't actually true. And then kind of this funny thing happened when it came out and started getting a following was I found out that a lot of people, because they knew who I am and they knew that I wrote it, just assumed that she was. They just were like, oh, yeah, obviously.
Even That's so strange.
It's like never really mentioned. Like, she's physically described, and I guess like maybe that could lead people to thinking that she's Asian, but I think like my mind was still so on the like, oh, the default is white, like unless you say otherwise, character is white. So that was really interesting to me. And so when I started writing Heroine Complex, which is my kind of urban fantasy romance series about Asian American superheroines having adventures in San Francisco, I was like, I always want to be able to say that this was like a more like noble thought process, but I was really like, well, I might as well make this character Asian because everybody's going to think that anyway.
I just think that's so insane. Like, I've never heard people like assuming that a character was of color. Like, usually it's the exact opposite.
I mean, I think some of it was combining with that thing where it seems like there's a lot of assumptions, especially with women, that we're only writing about ourselves over and over again. And it's like thinly veiled versions of our lives. And we obviously have no imagination, so we can't think of anything else. And so I think like, and, you know, to be fair, that character was a lot like me. So I can kind of see where maybe people got that from. But
that idea is so old, and it is frustrating that that is still around.
Yeah.
I liked something on Twitter the other day that was like, kind of reading, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as this autobiographical take on her relationship with Percy Shelley. Yeah. And then I saw a very long Twitter thread that was like, here's why that's not good.
Right. Well, we talked to Mallory O'Mara a couple weeks ago, and I went on a huge tangent because the movies that everyone knows, like The Birds and Rebecca, were actually adaptations of Daphne du Maurier's novels, because she was like a muse for him, basically. Like, he was so inspired by her work and always like tried to adapt her work. But because that happened so often, it got to the point where even though she was doing the work first, people were like, you're only writing books because you want movies to be made of them so that you can have lots of money.
Good for her.
I mean,
and it's like, maybe women just like to write things, yeah, and like, they're good at it.
It's weird that there can be like no other motivation, or that, you know, we can't imagine things that are beyond ourselves for some reason. But yeah, it was, so that was all very interesting. And then I felt like as I was writing what became Heroine Complex, that's when I really started to feel like, oh, wow, I am writing basically something that is kind of inspired by a lot of things I loved when I was growing up, by superheroes and comic books and these sort of larger than life narratives and romance and, you know, all of these things I was kind of trying to put in the blender. And I was like, oh, this actually feels really good. It feels like empowering to have these characters who I can imagine look like me and look like my friends that are at the center of this story. So initially, I think it was a very sort of like not complicated decision. But as it went on, I started to feel just more empowered by that and just like really loving being able to write these like fun romantic adventures with Asian American heroines. So that was something that I wanted to keep doing. And I don't really see a scenario where I will ever not do that. You know, I think I've also, for some reason.
No, I think that's great. Like, who is it? Jordan Peele. He was asked if he would ever, you know, make horror movies about other people besides black people. And he was like, there's enough of those. I'm trying to tell my own story that I want to tell.
Right. Like, I think like, that's so interesting. Like, I love that he said that because I think it's weird that like, when you're writing like your own sort of identity and your person of color or like marginalized in some way, that someone would see like the ultimate prize being that you get to write about white people. Like, I think that's like sort of a weird thing. And I'm kind of like I got the question a lot, especially when the first book debuted, you know, people asking me like, well, do you feel pigeonholed? Like, are you worried that this will pigeonhole you? And I was kind of like, honestly, it took me so long to get to this point of believing that I could write this and people believing that these stories and these characters did have like big commercial appeal. That felt like such a battle that I don't see why I would stop. I don't see why.
Well, that's the thing, you know. Right? Like, what is it really pigeonholing? Like, oh no, I have to write about the thing that I'm specifically interested in writing about. What will I ever do?
Yeah, it's. I thought that was like a weird question, but I really did think about it because I got it a lot, and I did feel like this sort of hidden thing behind that question was like, well, don't you want the real prize, which is, you know, I guess writing white people. And I was like, I mean, I don't really think that's like the prize, but sure, I have.
It's just funny too because I feel like it's very descriptive of the fact that they don't read a lot of your work, because it's not as if every single character in every single book that you've ever written is only Asian.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we deal a lot, and I think this is another thing that, you know, I'm sure that you have dealt with as well, where it's kind of like, if you have like more than one character that's like a similar marginalized background, like the fact that I had two Asian American women leads, like people were kind of like, oh, like, you know.
Oh, absolutely. When I draw like more than one fat person, or like I feel that in real life too. Like if I'm hanging out with another fat person that doesn't identify as cisgendered, mm-hmm. like people are like, well, you guys are just pretending to be popular with each other. And it's like, no, more than one type of person can exist in the same space at the same time.
And many times we like to be friends with each other. That's like a natural.
It's almost like we have something in common.
Yeah, for sure.
So I did want to ask, so like, obviously Sarah and I have experience with looking for our own identities being represented throughout media. But Matt, you know, as a cishet white guy, like,
oh, I'm getting questions here.
Okay. Well, I'm curious because, you know, obviously every time you turn on the TV or open a book, you're gonna see yourself represented. So what kind of like drew you to, you know, search for something more than just a reflection of self? Like, I love reading and consuming material that's not about even any of the, like, marginalized groups I'm part of, because I feel like it's a great learning experience. But, you know, I'm just curious what your perspective is on it, like, how you got into reading representative media.
I mean, I'll say first off that I've never come to literature to see a reflection of myself. I of course, sort of had that built-in, like, identification with characters. Yeah. I don't know how much I consciously thought about, like, oh, this person is just another, you know, white boy like me. So I don't think, like, there's that kind of dissonance when I think about identification. Because, like you guys have said, that the default is white, right? Yeah. So it was not something I ever had to consciously think about or question or whatever. But, I mean, most of what I read growing up and kind of into being a young adult was fantasy, science fiction. And then I started getting really into, like, Latin American literature and reading stuff in translation. So I never, I mean, I don't want to say never. Never is not a good word. I'm just drawn to good stories. I sound so lame saying this. How do I not sound lame?
No, not at all.
Because I don't, this is like the reading version of I don't see color. Because I do. Not trying to
but
be
it does
guy.
Seem like it was a more natural graduation for you. Like, you followed interest. You weren't... I do feel like a lot of people, when they're consuming media, like, you know, they assume that, you know, when Sarah writes an Asian person or I, like, draw a fat person, that we're trying to mirror ourselves. And I think that a lot of that comes from people are trying to see a reflection of themselves in the media they consume.
Yeah, I'll say that there's... I think fantasy and sci-fi and genres like that are really good trainers for being open to diversity, because there's a suspension of disbelief there. You know, that you're entering into worlds that you don't know. There's that discomfort level, like every time you start a new world, especially like epic fantasy, where it's like completely disconnected from the world we live in. You have to be open to these new things and these strange words. And, you know, that can be hard to get over, the strangeness of it. I remember putting down Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone when I was a kid because I didn't know what a lemon head was in the first chapter. And I was like, this is dumb. I had to get over that. And fantasy was a great way to train myself to just be open to different voices and different ways of looking at the world. And going into, you know, English programs and comparative literature programs makes you really question all the things that you're reading and who's being represented and who's authoring whose story. So it's been 10 years of training that, though.
Something I think is so interesting is because you brought up fantasy, and it did make me think about I know that some people of marginalized identities have had sort of like a tiff with fantasy at times, because there does seem to be a commonality in a lot of the universes where, like if we're talking, like, you know, elves and gnomes and, like, you know, supernatural beings, that there tends to be a lot more comfort for authors in, like, blue and green skin characters than actually, like, putting in black people into fantasy worlds, mm-hmm. or actually representing, like, human races.
Yeah.
And I remember that the Adventure Zone, that podcast, when it got going, they had originally discussed that, like, Taco, one of the characters, was, like, this, like, deep blue color. And, you know, some fans, like, reached out and were like, hey, that's usually, like, the fantasy sort of sidestep to being, like, you can read this character as a person of color if you want to. And it was really great because, you know, like, the McElroy brothers that do that show, you know, they're three white guys that are brothers, and they actually listened, and they, you know, they went back and changed some things. And I think that's great. I think it's really important when people that are writing, whether it be explicit or coded versions of minority representation, listen when the actual people looking for the representation are like, hey, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting with fantasy because I think, on the one hand, I think that a lot of readers of genre, whether it's fantasy or mystery or romance, are such voracious readers that a lot of times they will be more open to, you know, reading about characters with backgrounds that are perhaps not their own, just because they're looking for so much content. They're like, oh, I will read like all of this. I want to sort of have like, you know, a complete set. Of,
they're like, I will read anything.
Yeah, like everything. And that, I think, opens you up more to discoverability. But certainly there is still that problem where, like, I think, especially if you're writing something like epic fantasy where you're doing a lot of world building and you're creating new species and new races of characters and things like that, sometimes, especially if you're inspired by the quote-unquote classics, there's obviously some not great stuff in there. So I remember reading...
What do you mean?
Well, I remember reading something, and I do not remember which book this was or which... I mean, honestly, it was probably... I've probably read this from, like, several authors, but it was someone saying, like, oh, I was really inspired by, like, the orcs and, like, all this stuff. And, like, it wasn't meant to be, like, an analog for, like, a person of color, but it was, like, inspired by this fantasy race. And it was like, okay, the orcs are, like... The idea of orcs is, like, actually, like, super racist. Like, it came out of, like, a racist idea. So, you know, you have to also think about what you're being inspired by when you're creating these new things and making sure that it's not, like, kind of this obvious analog to something that might exist in real life.
Absolutely. Like, there's definitely a strong difference between, like, caricature and character.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like there's a lot of stuff that really doesn't realize that there's quite a large difference.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about just, you know, why diversity and representation in media is important. You know, Matt, you started talking about your childhood and how, you know, reading fantasy opened you up to being able to explore and move into different cultures' literature, which is fantastic. But I do see a pattern of, like, you know, when kids aren't given literature and, you know, movies and TV that has representation in it, they're less apt to seek it out. So, you know... Did you guys have, like, things in your childhood where you, like, distinctly remember reading something or seeing something and being like, that's a character or an archetype that I never thought I would see represented in, like, something? Like, you saw yourself or you saw something that you were looking for in media, I guess I'm trying to say.
I mean, for me, I've talked about this a lot, but it was probably Claudia Kishi in the Babysitter's Club. She was Japanese American, and she was one of the main characters. She was on the cover. You know, she was growing up in the suburbs, and she, what I really love about her still is that she kind of broke the sort of model minority idea that was often kind of put upon Asian American characters. You know, she was bad at school. She was terrible at math. She was an artist. She was creative. She was the best dresser. It's where I find a lot of my style inspiration still. And she, you know, she did things like she read Nancy Drew novels. She hid candy in books. Like, she was obsessed with junk food. Like, these were all sort of things that I had never really seen given to a character of color, and especially an Asian American character. And I don't think at the time I quite grasped how important that was until later. But especially for, you know, the time those books first came out, I think that was actually quite revolutionary. And it was definitely something that I could see myself in. that it, and it wasn't sort of like, oh, you know, Claudia is here to teach us about racism. We're going to write a very special book where she, although I think there was actually a book later where she had to know that.
I was
going to
say, I'm pretty sure that there was at least one.
But it wasn't like, it was like later in the series, and it wasn't like her only story, you know, like she had like a lot of stories. She was a very like full character. She got just as much of a spotlight as the other babysitters. And she was actually quite popular. Like, I didn't realize until later, you know, when we started being able to connect with each other on the internet, but she was definitely important for a lot of Asian American women. And I was surprised to find out she was actually also a lot of like non-Asian girls' favorite. Like, you know,
she was my favorite.
And that's so amazing to me, because I feel like usually, especially in that era, the sort of girl of color would not be the one that everybody wanted to be. Like, that was just usually not the case. So I think she was obviously very important. And that's one of the first times I can remember seeing an Asian American, Japanese American, like, regular girl just treated, you know, as the protagonist and as the main character alongside the others.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of, like, representation I saw, like, growing up, because, like, I'm Greek and I'm Cherokee, and the only Native American representation I ever saw in my childhood, like, as far as, like, media went, was Pocahontas, and, I mean, I don't have to explain to you why that is not okay. And then, you know, like, I mean, yeah, there was Hercules, but, man, they got it so wrong.
And My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah, no, oh my god, after that came out, so many Windex jokes at my expense.
Oh god.
and like, it got worse because, like, my family hails from Sparta, so when 300 came out, oh man, I still get people that scream it at me to this day when I mention where my family's from, and I'm just like, you know, they didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
But I can't think of any instance of a fat character or a non-binary character, like, existing without it being about their character until I saw, like, Steven Universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had all sorts of body types and gender identities and, you know, the representation there, like, it was always like, you know, gems form different ways. This is just the form that they're most comfortable in. And, you know, I think that's so great and very important. Like, I feel like a lot of cartoons today are very much geared towards giving children the representation that, you know, I feel like could have saved me a lot of self-deprecating and heartache, like, as a child. And I'm glad to see that things are, like, moving in such a positive direction. You know, that's how I felt when Shadow of the Batgirl got announced. Like, I know that book is going to be so important to so many, like, young female Asian comic readers.
I mean, I hope so. I think it was important for us that she was Batgirl. Like, Cassandra Cain has obviously had a lot of different identities. And there have also been, you know, different people who have taken on the Batgirl mantle. And I think
just a few.
Yeah, just a few. But I think that's, like, another question that we get asked a lot. Like, whenever this sort of debate comes up, there's, like, this idea that some people put forth where they're like, well, you know, Batgirl, well, she has to be white, so why don't you just, like, create your own character who's a superhero? And I'm like, well, I did that. But also, these characters have such, these legacy characters are still so important. They're still so iconic. They're, you know, everybody knows Batman, Superman, Supergirl, like, everybody knows those names and those characters. So I think it's really powerful for everybody to be able to see themselves in that, you know, like, I think what you were talking about with Steven Universe is so important, because things like that, I think, also show us and show the kids who are watching or reading that also, if you are of a marginalized identity that's not seen as much in media, you also don't always have to be miserable. Like, your story doesn't have to be that you're miserable. You cannot possibly be happy because you're not.
And if anything, like, that is, like, that's the hole that, like, marginalized characters fall into. It's like, if you're gonna write about being LGBT, it better be about getting beaten up for right. it. Or if you're going to write it about being, you know, a different race than white, it better be because you were bullied severely. Like, it always has to be someone hurting you.
And yeah.
I feel like marginalized identities, when represented badly, it's always used in the same way that, like, sexual assault and, like, terrible things like that are to, like, further a character's development.
Yeah.
It's, like, never, like, oh, I just happen to be in love and also fat.
Yeah. I mean, it's, like...
Like, my God!
I'm always, like, we have other experiences. Like, we are happy sometimes. We have, like, other things going on besides, like, people being mean to us. I mean, of course that happens and still needs to be talked about, but... We have just as wide a range of experiences as what we think of as, you know, the default sort of white, straight, thin characters. Like, there can be a diversity of experiences within all of our experiences as well.
It sounds very simple, but that is so important. I think my only sort of claim to any sort of diversity is I have Crohn's disease. So, you know, invisible illness. And I think the best representation that I've seen of it so far is those pharmaceutical commercials. which is not great. Right.
Right.
No.
Those commercials are pretty good, though. They do tell they try to tell a story. I feel like I'm always like, oh, there's like a narrative happening here. But obviously, yeah. There could be much more out there.
I just always think about the Cymbalta one of, like, the little, like, it looks like a little steam bun. Oh, that's, yeah. Like,
he's sad.
Hopping around.
Yeah, but then you have to start thinking about, why am I being advertised pharmaceuticals when, you know, my doctor should be telling me which ones I should take?
Right.
Like, ask
something
your doctor.
About the pharmaceutical industry is maybe
something's
a little
off
iffy.
There. We
but
should
no,
look
Matt,
into that.
You're totally right. And it's not even something that I wrote down, but, you know, I also live with, like, a chronic pain problem and another, like, invisible thing. And it's never represented in media. The most we get usually is, like, a able-bodied person pretending that they need a wheelchair right. or pretending to be blind when they're daredevil. Like, we don't really get, like, I feel like it's getting better. I feel like I've seen actual representation of actually, like, disabled folks or people with, like, mental illness or people with invisible illness. But, like, it's not enough.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I watched that show, Superstore, and, like, there's a character on it, Garrett, who's in a wheelchair. And when I saw that actor, like, on Twitter the other day, and he, in fact, does not need a wheelchair, I was, like, floored. I was like, I just thought, you know, and I don't like that. It feels weird. It's the same thing to me as, like, when they, like, hired, God, Jared Leto, I think it was, to, like, play a trans person. Like, there are trans actors. There are disabled actors that deserve to get the work.
Yeah, it and feels it, like we're still, like, very behind in that aspect, like, for so many different identities. Like, I feel like people finally sort of realize, maybe we should not do blackface. Maybe we should not, like...
They're still on the fence about that, Sarah.
Yeah, there's, I mean, there's a lot of debate on that one still.
I'm not saying it's gone entirely, but, you know, there's at least, like, a little bit of a feeling of, like, maybe we shouldn't, like, put a bunch of heavy makeup on our eyes and say that we're Asian. Like, you know, just things like that. It seems like we're still sort of crawling towards the, like, more of that where it's like, you know, actually, if you want this character to kind of have that lived experience, that performance that can really give that lived experience, which brings up things that if you are not of that marginalization, you probably wouldn't even think of. That's important. I feel like it's like baby steps to get there, but I'm hoping that we're at least starting to have those conversations.
I think part of the problem is on the one hand, you have this sort of, the stalwarts of tradition who have the response to, you know, things like changing the race of a character, who say, you know, Batgirl is always white, you know, come up with your own character. On the other hand, you have, you know, whiteness being this sort of blank template upon which other stories can be put upon and have this sort of air of progressivism.
Right.
And so you have to, I think the most important thing that I've kind of come across, or the thing that I hear the most, is just listen, right?
Yeah.
And that's really hard to do when we're sort of trained to always give our take and have an opinion or to critique.
I think that there's something so powerful in being like, I don't know enough about a subject to critique it or to say anything about it. Like, I know literally nothing about Crohn's disease, so I would never, like, sit here and be like, oh, Matt, well, I think this, this, and this right. about what you've got to say.
It would make for a really shitty story.
Yeah. But I think that's so true, too. Like, and that's the funny thing, right, about the Batgirl situation specifically, because it's not, like, people see it and they have that instant response of, like, well, Batgirl is white. You can't change her race. But it's not changing her race if Barbara Gordon is still a different character than Cassandra Cain, and they're two different women entirely.
Yeah.
And I mean, people just don't want to see that.
Well, and I think especially with things like legacy characters in superhero narratives, it's like there's so much opportunity to kind of open that up. Like, there's so much power in doing that, and these are mantles. They're not necessarily like applied to one person. A lot of times several people are taking on that identity. I mean, I think that Into the Spider-Verse did such a beautiful job with that.
Like,
I love that sort of the idea of that was anyone can wear the mask, everyone can wear the mask. Like, we have these characters who are all so different, but they are united under this one banner and under the idea that they want to do good in the world. Like, it, again, it sounds like such a simple concept, but apparently it blows some people's minds apart still.
I just love that we've segued into this, because if you will look below, I'm going to send you some visual representations of what I'm going to be discussing. And for you listening at home, they will be linked in the description. So here is Faith. She is a superhero. I don't know, Matt, if you're familiar, but she is a plus-size superhero. And if you look at the picture, Marguerite Savant did the art on and off. And, I mean, you can really tell when artists know and don't know how to draw fat people. And she definitely knows how to draw fat people. But if you look at the second image I'm about to send you, you're going to see that she looked a little different back when she was created by Jim Shooter and David Lapham.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Faith was created as part of the Valiant Comics universe when she was made. You know, skinny, tiny, blonde woman, same powers, different name. But when they did the big Valiant reboot, they decided to make her, you know, who we know as Faith, which is the first real fat female superhero. And, you know, I think people had a really hard time accepting this one, even though she hadn't really been significantly used for a long time.
Yeah.
But people were so angry that they made her fat. And I think that it's, like, insane to me as someone who has been underweight and overweight. The concept of changing a character's weight and them still doing the same job is far more easy a pill to swallow, I would think, if I was, like, an awful bigot, than, like, changing a character's race. And yet, people were quite upset with that one.
Yeah, that...
You know, I think she's super cute. No, and plus, like, she has huge boobs, and don't, like, sexist people like that sort of thing?
No, she is super cute. I mean, I think, like, what I really loved about what they did with Faith, especially, was that she was so fun. Like, they just made her so joyful, and I loved how she was, like, you know, kind of a fangirl, and she really like relished like the superhero job, since a lot of times like our favorite superheroes are like sort of reluctant to take up the mantle. They're like, oh no, I can't.
And she was
can't.
Like, hell like, yeah.
Yeah, like they're like tortured by it. I love that that was so joyful. And you know, like I said, that's something like I'm kind of always looking for in stories about characters that have marginalized identities that we maybe haven't seen as much of before. I love that it wasn't like, oh no, she's like sad and she's just in her apartment. Like it was like, no, she loves this. Like she's having such a good time.
You know what I absolutely loved? I loved her big, hunky, buff boyfriend that she had that was also a superhero. Like, I feel like I love pissing off fatphobic people because, like, of course I do. But, like, nothing makes fatphobic people angrier than a quote-unquote healthy-bodied person being attracted to fat people. Like, I just have to imagine that, like, somewhere, some, like, crappy Sonic the Hedgehog fan is, like, so angry that David is dating me because he's a twig and I'm, you know, fat.
Yeah, I love that, too. I mean, I always love, like, any romance, but I thought that, like, and again, it was just something where, like, this is fun. This is, like, not, like, a sad, tortured kind of superhero story, even though I like plenty of those, but it just felt so refreshing, and it felt refreshing, too, because it was a character being a superhero who we don't see that much. I thought that was really lovely.
So, I have a question can play into this discussion, but you know, on the one hand there's representation visually, right? So TV, film, and seeing yourself that way, and then there's literature, books, whatever, and so there's the visual side of it, but then books offer more of an interiority to it. Do you guys have any thoughts on how these different mediums affect the way that we see diverse stories, or do you find that one's more suited to certain, wakening up people to certain viewpoints?
I feel like it can be so anxiety inducing to have, like, I think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with if you're willing to listen and do the research and have people on your team that are of the identities. But, like, I get so anxious when, like, a skinny person writes a fat character in a novel. Yeah. Or, like, a straight person writes about, like, transgender identity. Like, I just, the entire time, even if it's a great book, like, I have to reach a certain point where I, like, don't feel anxious. Because I'm just, like, I feel like when I'm reading novels, because, you know, you have to rely on the internal, like, monologue and the description and, you know, very detailed accounts of the character to get a feel for them, I'm always very concerned about when it's going to turn south. Like, when, like, I'm, every time I read a skinny person writing a fat character, I'm like, when are you going to talk about how they need to lose weight? I know it's coming, right. So can we just get there?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because it's certainly, you know, something I'm always thinking about as a writer. I'm, you know, even though I most of my main characters are Asian American women, obviously I don't have like an entire cast that is only one identity. So I'm always, I think also if you have a point, like points of marginalization, if you are marginalized in some way, you are hopefully more sensitive to that. I mean, I know I've certainly tortured myself a lot about writing my own identity in a way that I know some white writers apparently do not think about. But I'm always thinking about that. So I try to extend that to other characters when I'm writing them as well. I had in, I think it was the second book, the second heroine complex book, there was a side character who is an Indian American woman, and she was so fun to write. She ended up being kind of more important and more central to the story than I thought she would be. And I was writing and I was kind of like, well, I mean, this is like adjacent to my identity, but it's not exactly my identity. I feel like there are things that I just won't know or I won't be aware of. So I ended up hiring a couple of sensitivity readers, and I felt like that was really interesting because it was just, I feel like a lot of times it's like in those details, right? Those kind of day-to-day details. So I remember one of the readers was like, oh, you know, this character loves like fancy vintage dresses. And she was like, oh, I love that you, you chose colors that look good with my skin tone. Because sometimes when people are writing like this person with a deep brown skin tone, they'll dress her in these colors that like I would never wear or that look really bad on me. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think of that. I'm glad that I accidentally chose these good colors. And I hope you'll tell me if I chose bad ones. But it's one of those things that it's not like if you were reading that, that would necessarily be a deal breaker. But it would kind of take you out of like, oh, obviously this person doesn't know that this color would look terrible on me.
I mean, it's exactly what you said before about how like marginalized people writing about marginalized identities or portraying them or what have you have that intimate experience with having to live that life.
Yeah.
That you bring something to the table that, you know, another author of a different identity might not.
I think that's the hope, is that we can all kind of have that empathy and extend it to our characters and our readers. And I think it's interesting what you brought up, Matt, as far as like, is there kind of like, what's kind of the difference between different mediums? And I think for me, it's just that like with prose, I have, I try to be very specific with characters. I think like for a while there was kind of this idea of like, oh, just be, you know, if you're ambiguous, the reader can like project themselves onto this character, or like this character could be anything. And there's also that like idea of like when people are like, oh, this character just happens to be X. And I'm like, that's not how that works. I mean, no. I understand what you're saying. I understand that the intention behind that is noble. But I like, if you decide to make a character white and straight and thin and cis, that's still a choice. You're making that choice. And whatever identity this character has, whether they're marginalized or not, the way they move through the world and the way that people react to them is going to be different. And that's kind of like the specificity you have to get into. So I've tried to be, you know, much more aware of that. I do, like with the first heroine complex, I think like at first, like when they were kind of talking about themselves and introducing themselves, I left the descriptions a little vague. And then later I went back in and I was like, you know what? No, I'm just going to have them say like, we're Asian and we're specifically,
oh, I love that double down.
Like, we're specifically this kind of Asian, because I think that's important. I don't want, you know, this situation, like maybe it was because, I don't know if you guys remember like when the first Hunger Games movie was like getting cast, and they cast, a black actress as Rue, and people were like, what?
Were so angry.
And you were like, did you read the description? Like, also, does it matter? Like, why are you so mad? But also, I'm like, okay, I'm also like writing in a more contemporary world where, you know, it's not like, these aren't like fantasy races. These are like real races. So I was like, I feel like I just want to be as specific as possible. And I do try to be as specific as possible in the prose so that you know who everyone is and what their backgrounds are and how that kind of influences how they move through the world. And then it's interesting with comics, because obviously you have the visual. So I think like with those, like it's maybe there's not as much maybe internal monologue. It's not like Cassandra Cain, I don't think at any point like says like, I'm Asian, but obviously looking at her, you know, she's Asian American. You know,
I don't know why, but as soon as you brought comics back into it, all I thought of was like, I had a flash in my mind of Iron Fist.
Oh
man, talk about a hit and a miss of a character. Like, when they originally drew him, they did that very like ambiguous thing, mm-hmm. of like, you could read him as an Asian character if you want to see that.
Yeah.
And then someday they just decided, huh?
I said they Ben Kingsley'd him.
Yeah, literally.
Literally. No, I think like it's because then you're like, well, I feel like also if I don't make it obvious, like a lot of like white people will be like, oh, this character is white. And you're like, do you have eyes? Like, are you looking at the same thing that I'm looking at?
Something that yeah. I think is really good in literature, just going back to Matt's question, versus other forms of media, I feel like we get to see a lot more honesty about disability, mental and physical illnesses, you know, invisible illnesses. I feel like that sort of existence is represented much better in book form than any other media. Mm. I remember reading The Reason I Jump. It was by Naoki, Naoki Higashida, I believe. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry if I said that wrong. I probably butchered it. But it was, he's 13. And it was translated into English and it became like a New York Times bestseller. But it was about his personal experience with autism. Mm. And like, it's a beautiful book. I think that it's like a must read, honestly. And I mean, it really blew up. Like the John Stewart reviewed it. Mm. It was, you know, best book of the year for NPR, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Business, like, and it's just great. Like, I feel like books have always done a lot better at representing disabled folks than any other form of media, especially comics. I feel like comics really like to play with, I don't need this wheelchair.
Right.
I was lying. No, but I do need it.
Right.
This is narrative prosthesis is what that's called. Jenny's thing is studying disability in literature. So,
yeah, I know that she knows a lot about that.
She does. So using disability as a plot device, essentially.
Right.
They love to do that with Professor X.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that was one reason it was, I think, really important for us to have Barbara Gordon represented as Oracle in Shadow of the Batgirl. I just felt like that character was so important to people.
Oracle is such a good character.
She's a great character, and I thought
when they quote unquote fixed her, like they put it, ugh, I was so angry.
I mean,
there's my one F word of our PG-13 show.
You get one.
I almost did it. I almost got through the whole episode.
No, she's great, and I think that it's also like one thing we kind of tried to do with that also was to have this idea that like. I guess sort of a spoiler, but like at the end when Cassandra officially kind of takes on the Batgirl mantle, she asks her first, don't you want to be Batgirl again? Like that is obviously something you loved. Is it?
Which is great.
Yeah. And cause I always like what I really like didn't like about that was that it was like, oh, because she's, you know, in the wheelchair, she can't be Batgirl. Like that's impossible. It was kind of like, well, there's a lot of different ways to be a hero. Like, you know, she can
there's only two.
She can still fight, she can still investigate, she obviously has a lot of amazing skills. Like, why can't she be Batgirl? And we tried to really have her explain it in a way that was like, this is not me anymore, this identity is not me anymore, not because I am in a wheelchair, but because it's just I feel like I am more like this now. I like these things about being a hero better. So Batgirl doesn't really feel like me.
So this is the tiniest little version of that. But if you've seen the reactions to Robert Pattinson's quarantine workout and how upset people are that he's not getting ripped for the role, like he's just eating cereal all day.
How dare he?
But people are so upset. They're like, why does Batman have to be ripped? We could have all done without buff Ben Affleck, personally.
I mean, we've had so many versions of Batman. It's like, it is, you know, if we're going to do another one, let's do something a little bit different. Like, it's still like a handsome white dude, but we can do something.
I'm really excited. I think that Robert Pattinson is hot. He's like a artsy, hot boy that likes to read books and date like artsy fartsy girls, and
yeah, and he obviously like is very entertaining, like, you know, he has like his own thing going on. I'm just looking forward to the press tour personally.
I was just about to say that. I was like, I can't wait for him to be like, you know what, now that it's over, I hate Batman.
Yeah.
So speaking of press tours, do you feel like the pressure or expectations as an Asian American writer to explain Asian American experience?
I mean, it depends. I mean, I would say, like, maybe I have in the past, but now I'm kind of like, I don't really want to. I mean, I think, I kind of go in now with the expectation that my audience is largely young women of color, and they don't really need like a 101. Like, if there's something they don't know, they can look it up or they can guess it from the context clues. I do remember that came up with my YA novel, I Love You So Mochi, which is...
I love that novel.
Thank you. You know, it's about a Japanese-American girl. She goes on spring break to Japan. A lot of it's set in Japan. There are a lot of Japanese words and foods and, like, different things that are referred to. And I can't remember. I don't think the publisher asked me this. It wasn't ever really a consideration, but someone at some point said, like, oh, do you think you need a glossary in the back to like explain some of these Japanese words? And I was like, no. No, I don't think
Google
so.
Is free.
Like, Google is free. A lot of these things are not like super mysterious. You can find them at the grocery store.
My god, what is mochi?
Most people know what a kimono is. Like, it's just like, and also I feel like that puts kind of a white gaze on it. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, of course, like, we have to, like, write this kind of so that white people understand.
Cater to white people.
Right, and I'm like, I don't feel like this is written from this gaze because I wrote it. And I don't really feel like the main audience is necessarily that, although, you know, of course, like, everyone can read it, and if there's something someone doesn't understand, I just would hope they would just look it up or guess what it is,
right?
Or, you know. Yeah,
context clues are really helpful. Like,
yeah.
I love The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao by Junot Diaz.
Mm.
And he includes, you know, a bunch of Spanish words in there with no glossary, no help whatsoever, but it doesn't ruin the experience of reading it at all. You know, it just... It brings a richness to it that you would otherwise not have there.
Right.
I know he's a little problematic, but it's still a good book.
Yeah, but
yeah,
just talking
I
about
agree.
Like how, you know, how people kind of do that. Like, I do. I mean, I like that as a reader when I'm not of the background that I'm reading about, or characters not of the, you know, of my same background. It just feels like more like the writer was writing, you know, what they wanted to write authentically about their own experience and not feeling like they had to stop and explain it. And so, you know, I just feel really good for the writer in that situation.
Yeah. And there's not this universal English, right? Having blended languages, you know, mixing in words, that's like a very normal experience for much of, you know, the American population. I don't know what percent is bilingual or has a different language other than English spoken at home, but it's a lot of people.
It's a lot.
So
I have no number on that either.
No, I didn't do my research on that because I didn't know I'd be talking about this, but
it's okay, Matt.
I know. And I lost my train of thought, but I love reading that in books, and it doesn't ruin the experience. I know it does for people, but I think they're wrong.
So we are getting close to the end now, and I was going to segue this earlier, but conversation was good. But also, speaking about press, Sarah, tell us about Haunted Heroine.
Of course. Haunted Heroine is the fourth book in the Heroine Complex series, and the first trilogy, you know, each book had a different POV. So the first book was Evie Tanaka, who is, at the beginning of the series, she's the personal assistant to the most fabulous superheroine in San Francisco. And then she ends up, of course, becoming a superheroine herself. The second book was Veda Jupiter, who is that very diva-like superheroine. And the third book was from the POV of Bee Tanaka, who's Evie's little sister. And then we had kind of an interstitial novella, which was about Lucy, who is kind of the bodyguard fight trainer for the team. So this, this next trilogy, we're doing a second trilogy, and this is the first book in that, and we're going back to Evie's perspective. I just kind of wanted to return to her. I felt like I wasn't quite done with her story. So it's a little
Sarah,
bit...
I'm so excited. I didn't realize that this was the next one, and I didn't realize that this was a new trilogy.
Yes, well, you know, it's kind of like, it's like kind of both a continuation of the series, but it's also like a new trilogy. So each heroine has her own book again. So Evie, Aveda, Bee, they all kind of get a sequel. And we did a little bit of a time jump in book three. So we're in that timeline where, Evie is now in her early 30s and she is pregnant. And, she has to, her mission in the book is she has to return to, the college where she went to grad school, which was the site of kind of the inciting incident of her life. Where she got really mad about something and she burned down the library with her firepower that she's been trying to suppress for many years. And so she's never gone back and she has to go back in her superheroine capacity and solve a supernatural mystery that's happening there. And I kind of was inspired by the college that it's set at is the Haunted Women's College in Oakland. And I attended a haunted women's college in Oakland.
I was like, wait a minute, I know about this.
So it's it was a lot of fun. Obviously, only the good parts are based on the actual college I went to. The rest of it I made up. But
of course,
you know, my school, which is Mills College, they were sort of known for being haunted because there were all these weird old buildings. There are always like unexplained noises and people seeing things. There were kind of these legacy ghosts that everybody knew about that had haunted the college for like decades. And so I really loved that setting and I wanted to play with it. And so I based some of the ghosts on some of the Mills ghosts and we had a lot of fun with that. And I also wanted to make it kind of my version of the like Babysitter's Club, like Sweet Valley High, like super special books. So the first, this one is set during Halloween. So it's like a Halloween super special.
Sarah.
And so we had a lot, I had a lot.
You're killing me. You have to let me read the arc.
I will. I'll send it to you. It was really
I'm
fun.
I'm gonna cry.
It was really fun to write. I don't know what super special I'm going to, super special style I'm going to tackle next, but I hope people enjoy reading a Halloween-themed book during the summer because that's when it's coming out.
No one will know whether or not it's actually Halloween
by
the summer,
true.
So
that
you're
is
fine.
True. Time means nothing.
I constantly
now.
Forget what day it is, so yeah, you're safe.
Good point. That's like, I guess, the plus side of something coming out during a pandemic. You're like, I don't know if this is actually, you know, holiday appropriate, but we'll just go with it.
I mean, I'm at the point where the only clean laundry I have is costumes. So
yeah.
Very well could be Halloween.
Amazing.
All right, guys, we're coming to the end of the show. So I just want to ask what everybody's TBR pile looks like. Sarah, for you and for anyone listening that's unfamiliar, every week we wrap up by asking what everyone is reading or plans to, aka their to-be-read pile. So Sarah, are you reading anything right now or anything you're excited to start reading?
Well, I have a lot of things I'm definitely excited to start. I have had a little bit of a reading slump during this crisis we're going through. I'm having a hard time, you know,
same,
really falling into a story, which is sad because that's what I love to do. But I have recently purchased some books that I hope kind of get me out of it. And one of the books I'm really looking forward to is Akemi Dawn Bowman's Harley in the Sky. She is such a beautiful writer. She wrote a book called Starfish that was about a biracial Asian American girl growing up in a very white town and kind of dealing with all of that, dealing with becoming an artist, like all of these things. And that book, I mean, it was one of those books that just like destroyed me in the best possible way. It's so beautifully written.
I love that feeling.
I mean, just like the emotions, like I felt like I was crying like the whole time. And it was one of those books where I was like, I'll just like start reading a couple chapters. And then I read the whole thing, stayed up really late. So I feel like she's a writer who always really draws me in. And this new book just sounds amazing and has a beautiful cover. And I feel like if someone could kind of break me out of this reading slump, she can do it.
What about you, Matt?
So I've got like an audiobook I'm listening to, which is The Ruin of Kings by Jess Lyons. I've got my Front Patio book, which is the first book in the Witcher series. And I've got three books on my nightstand that I'm bouncing between every night.
I love that.
But I think that on my to-be-read pile next is Tamora Pierce, because I made Jenny read one of the Star Wars books, and so the trade is I will read a Tamora Pierce book.
You won't regret it. It'll be good.
I don't think I will.
Speaking of Star Wars books, I'm still slowly working my way through the Poe Dameron YA novel by Alex Sugura, Freefall.
So excited for that.
Yes. I'm reading the advanced reader copy right now. Sarah, I'll send you the info for that
because yeah.
You can get at it. It will be available for sale in early August. Keep an eye out on the website. I believe pre-orders should be soon. Also, speaking of pre-orders, you can pre-order Sarah's newest book, Haunted Heroines, and get it right to your house when it comes out.
That's right.
Do pre-order. Pre-orders are so important, right?
They are.
Absolutely.
And especially right now, I feel like, you know, it's obviously always important, but more important than ever to support our indie bookstores. So I love when people tell me they've ordered from Mysterious Galaxy or The Rip Bodice or Borderlands or any of the wonderful indie bookstores that have supported me so much over the years.
Honestly, I can't believe we got through the whole episode without talking about The Rip Bodice. Like, I wrote notes about it.
No, that's like where I ordered Harley in the Sky from. I am so happy that, you know, they've been able to getting books to customers, and that Mysterious Galaxy's been able to do that as well, because these are places I just think of as like second and third homes, basically.
Absolutely, we are all sister stores.
Yeah, I want all the indie bookstores to keep thriving, because obviously we need stories right now, and we're going to need them whenever it is safe to actually go to an indie bookstore again or go anywhere again. I'm really, really happy whenever anyone tells me they pre-ordered from their favorite indie.
Thank you so much, Sarah,
for being
our guest today.
Thank you so much.
Go ahead, like we said, and go pre-order Haunted Heroine, the next in the Heroine Complex trilogy spinoff?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what to call
it
now.
It's like, you know, a continuation of this series, but also a new trilogy. It's kind of everything, you know. We'll see what people think.
I love it. So go pre-order that, and also go ahead and check out I Love You So Mochi or Shadow of the Batgirl, or catch up with the Heroine Complex series by going to mistgalaxy.com and clicking on the drop-down shop. Thank you so much to Austin Farmer for the use of our theme music. It's cut from the song Kill the Farm Boy off of his album Bookshelf Symphony Orchestra. And you can find a link to that as well as everything else we've discussed down below. And as always, you can email any questions for Gary and I to podcast@mistgalaxy.com. And to find out more news about upcoming events and new releases, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Mist Galaxy Books. I do know that we are doing some curbside pickups now, so go and find out about that through our Instagram. And we'll see you guys again soon. Hmm?
Who knows what it'll be like when you hear this episode, though.
That's true.
You know, you are... I'm stressed. I need to go drink some wine.
That's okay. You're doing hosting duties all by yourself. That's a big deal. I know.
Guys, please email us podcast@missgalaxy.com and send Gary pictures of your dog since he was sick. It will make him smile.
Yes.
We'll see you guys again soon in a galaxy not so far away.